From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we'll visit the completely revamped food lab at Mount Mary University and learn how it's integrated with the wider community.
Later, a look back at four decades of A Christmas Carol at the Milwaukee Rep.
We'll meet the muralist and designer responsible for the set and the unique lobby art for In Tandem Theater's new production.
I took posters from the era for music halls and recreated them in chalk. Then once the show closes, the walls get washed and it goes away.
Plus the latest edition of Bubbler Talk, an Oscar-winning and now Grammy-nominated composer Justin Hurwitz talks about his creative process.
When I compose it on the piano, I have a good sense of what it should be, but I still don't discover all the voicings and all the little counter-melodies and all that until I'm actually putting it on the page.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Notre Dame Hall, the iconic building on the Mount Mary University campus, was built nearly 90 years ago. But the work that goes on in one particular room is anything but historic. It's cutting-edge work being done in a space that serves the university and the community at large.
A $1 million renovation over the summer upgraded the school's food lab, the centerpiece for the only four-year food science degree offered in the Milwaukee area. The lab also serves the dietetics program at the school as well. I had a chance to stop by the renovated space recently and met with Ann Vravik, who teaches in the food science department. Thanks for having us out here.
You bet. It's great to have you.
Well, and so let's start with where we are. There's lots of clinking going on around us. Tell me about the room we're sitting in.
We are sitting in the new food lab here at Mount Mary University, and this is the space where we do the dietetics teaching as well as the food science teaching.
Well, give us a thumbnail sketch. I mean, I think people have a sense for what food science is and what dietetics are, but can you kind of give us a compare and contrast? What are those two disciplines as they're taught at Mount Mary?
Yeah, well, dietetics has a focus on patient health. And so they're looking at giving the best recipes, or I shouldn't say recipes, the best food and nutrition to someone who is in a state of poor health or in health that needs some improvement or some attention. Food science, on the other hand, we're studying the whys and hows. Where does food not only come from, but why does it do the things that it does when you cook it or store it or change its texture, flavor, all of that sort of thing.
And presumably these two disciplines actually relate to each other as well. There are needs for a food scientist to understand dietetics and a dietitian to understand food science.
Yes, quite a bit. In fact, dietetics relies on food science in order to improve the health of patients. Whereas in food science, we're interested in what it is that keeps the food healthy and nutritious.
Well, so, and you teach food science here. Mm-hmm. The students that come through your program, what do they go on to do?
Well, food science is really diverse. So you could be in an area of research and development, which in and of itself is quite diverse. So you could be interested in just studying the flavors of foods and getting them correctly balanced for the best flavor possible. You could be interested in the color. You could be interested in the preservation of food. You could be interested in the health area of food. And all of those in R&D are used in order to make the best particular food product that a company would be developing. So there's R&D. There's also areas like marketing. You could be in the area of just understanding food to the point where you're developing and marketing the product for sale. You could be in even the area of writing and promotion that way. So you could be doing food blogs or writing for magazines or newspapers, that sort of a thing. And then there's the quality area, food safety. There's a lot of people that go into determining whether or not food products are safe how they come off the line at a food processing plant, if they contain microorganisms or mycotoxins or things that would alter someone's, you know, health or response to the food. So there's all different kinds of places you can go with food science.
Well, give us a before and after kind of snapshot of what the food lab was like until just a few months ago and what you're able to do here today because of what's around us.
Well, previously we had a food lab that had a lot of feeling like it was grandma's 1950s kitchen. And it was lovely. It was perfectly stocked. It did its job. However, things were getting a little bit outdated in terms of technology. And we realized very quickly that we needed to keep up with the changing times. And if our students were going to be able to present themselves well enough in industry, sure, they had to have better technology. So we gutted this entire kitchen or this entire laboratory space. It's quite huge, as you can see.
Yeah.
And added additional lab spaces. So the cooking equipment is all up to date, and all of our lab technology is up to date as well.
So these are, I mean, brand new ovens, brand new stoves, brand new
right,
everything.
Right, exactly. Plus we added induction ovens, which is a whole new technology in cooking, which we felt that our students needed to understand. And induction cooking is an incredible new technology.
So explain induction cooking for
us. Well, induction cooking doesn't actually use the same sort of gas heating that we're used to, or even electrical heating. It does use electricity, but it creates a magnetic field. And the magnetic field then causes the pan to heat up. So it's not the stove itself that's cooking, it's the magnetism in the pan that's doing the cooking.
And so there's not an application of heat from one spot, the food is all heating up at the same rate?
It is, heating up at the same rate and then within the pan itself. So you can actually touch the cooktop and it's not hot, but the pan is hot. So that's how it works.
There is also, just on the other side of the wall to my left, something called a sensory evaluation lab, which at first blush looks like a big empty room.
Yeah.
Talk about the significance of that and how it relates to the lab we're in right now.
Yeah, the sensory lab is actually intended to be a big empty room. We want people that come in to taste different food products to not have any interference with smells or visual cues or things that might bias your opinion about a taste. So what people are doing is coming in to taste things that the food scientists have developed. So for example, a couple of weeks ago, we were looking at different mozzarella cheeses in terms of their fat content and how the fat then plays a role in what we perceive as saltiness. So they were studying whether or not high fat makes something taste less salty or more salty. So we had students and staff on campus come into that big empty room, sit down at their little desk spaces where there's no, no extra lighting, no smells, no anything. And we would pass food in then to them from this lab space into that big empty
right,
room.
Pass-through windows in this
right,
room, yes.
Those pass-through windows. And they couldn't then smell what was going on here in our lab. That was a very clean environment from which then to really concentrate on what they were tasting and whether or not they could sense the difference in the saltiness.
And I gather even the lighting in there is set up so that that takes one more stimulus away.
Exactly. So we have either natural lighting. So there are some cases where you want people to see differences in colors. There are other times where you don't want them to see differences in colors. So we have a whole different rainbow of colors of which we can add then to their tasting experience. So for example, this cheese that they were looking at, one of the recipes turned out to be a little bit more yellow than the other, and it was a difference in just a vitamin content of the two, and we didn't want that to bias their opinion
sure,
on the taste. So if you look at a yellow cheese, that doesn't always necessarily look as appetizing as a pure white cheese when you're thinking of mozzarella. So the lighting we had on a red hue, and the red color then cancels the yellow color, and you can really focus on just the flavor and not the difference in the visual aspect of it.
How many food science students do you have at Mount Mary?
Right now we have that are actually declared as food science majors. We have 6, and there are another 4 that are coming in the fall. We'll have a much bigger enrollment as the summer goes on. So we're expecting, we can handle up to 18 students per class. So we can handle quite a bit, and we're expecting this program to grow.
Well, and I was wondering whether the revamped food lab is part of the goal of it is to be able to expand the program.
Definitely. So we definitely now have the teaching space available to accommodate a lot more students. We also have this teaching space available to accommodate even ADA students. So one of the kitchen areas or the lab areas has lower countertops and spaces for wheelchairs to roll up to the counter and actually do the same work that someone on feet would be doing. And that is an advantage also to our occupational therapy group, because those students come in wheelchairs so that they can experience what it's like for someone who is using a wheelchair, how to manipulate themselves throughout the kitchen and to get the same things done.
Talk about the demonstration kitchen that is right here, because I gather this is something else that is greatly improved since the previous food lab.
Yeah. Our demonstration station is fabulous because it gives me an opportunity to demonstrate to the students exactly what I want the skills for them to learn. It also has a television screen rather than a chalkboard or a whiteboard. So I am actually not even using a chalkboard anymore in my teaching. I guess people haven't used chalkboard for forever, but with a whiteboard, I'm not drawing on anything anymore, except that I have an iPad now that I carry around, and I can actually draw on the iPad with my PowerPoints. So students are getting a much more interactive understanding of the teachings that I'm offering. So they see not only what I'm demonstrating on the station, but then I can also demonstrate it if I'm looking at a chemical equation, for example. I can write out that chemical equation on that TV screen there.
And so this large TV screen is split into multiple views, and they can see the equation. They can also
see the
three cameras showing what you're doing.
Exactly. So if I'm trying to show them something like, what a smoking oil looks like, I can actually zoom in on it and show them what they are supposed to be looking for.
Talk about the development process for this lab. How much of it was shaped by what you already knew you wanted, and how much was shaped by reaching out to industry around Milwaukee to find out what kinds of skills they're looking for in graduates?
Yeah, that's a great question. We actually have an advisory committee that we refer to for a lot of information on what industry is interested in. So our advisory committee consists of about 8 different food companies in the Milwaukee area, and they are experts in the food science world, and they join us by teleconference about once a month, once every 6 weeks, and we have offered up a number of questions to them about what they expect from a food scientist, and they continually give us feedback about things like whether or not certain regulations should be taught to the students, what sort of skills they should know, even details on the classes themselves. I had quite a few questions on what I should teach in food engineering, which is a very difficult course not only for the students to take, but also in order to just focus on the important areas in food engineering. I mean, you could go on and do an entire degree in that. So what were the important points about engineering that they needed to know in order to be effective food scientists in the real world?
Well, I wondered whether having a lab like this pushes the envelope for you even.
Oh, for sure. So I have already had multiple opportunities to expand my teaching in terms of what I'm showing the students. So for example, in our engineering class, for example, we were talking about induction cooking. They had to learn the equations, the electrical currents. They had to know all the details about what really goes into induction cooking from an engineering standpoint. So we came here into the lab and we actually did a few experiments right there on the stove so they could see what we were talking about, and what is that magnetism, what pans work, what don't, and why do they work, why do they not work, that sort of thing.
There are currently 6 food science students mm-hmm. with a possibility of 4 more coming in.
Yeah.
That's still not a huge number for such a big space like this. What opportunities are there for the greater community beyond the boundaries of Mount Mary University itself to take advantage of this space?
Oh, a lot of opportunities. In fact, we've had a number of discussions with industries in the area who are interested in using our sensory space for their own tasting. So whether or not they involve the students in that or whether they use it as an industry themselves. This sensory lab is actually something that's pretty unique to many companies in the area. Some are trying to now add these laboratories to their own spaces, but a lot of them don't have it.
And so places that are making food, they, at the moment, they don't necessarily have the ability to do taste testings in a controlled environment the way that you do here.
Correct. So let's say a company that makes chocolate, for example, has a request from a client or from a customer that they want a certain particular flavor to show up or to be a high note in that particular chocolate. When you're tasting it within just a pure laboratory environment or even within a conference room, there are so many factors then that play a role in your psychology when it comes to tasting. Whereas here you can eliminate all of that and really just focus on what is the actual flavor without all the distractions that you would get.
What are the psychological factors that play into how you're tasting chocolate, say?
Oh, it's crazy. So it's amazing how much your brain plays a role in taste. So for example, if you're on a diet and you are cutting out sugar from your diet, you're going to have a much different taste to sweetness than someone who is not on a diet. Let's say you're a smoker, that too will change your flavor. So those aren't necessarily psychological, except that they are physiological changes. But then there are psychological things like the memories that play a role when you taste something. There is a very big connection between memory and flavor. And all of us know, like, you know, particularly at Thanksgiving, that just that all the memories that come around with, you know, eating turkey and how grandma would make it versus how mom makes it versus all the different people in your family, all the things that happen throughout your life. So the memories play a role in that. And then there's other psychology, like whether or not you are just feeling okay that day. If you're just having a bad day, you may not enjoy a flavor as much as if you're just having a gosh darn good day and things are just happy.
Of course, if you're having a bad day, maybe tasting chocolate would give you,
true,
help you have a better day.
right? It should for all of us. If it doesn't, there's something wrong.
Well, along those lines, when this lab was coming together for you, having done what you've done for as long as you've done it, it must have been a little bit like the proverbial kid in the candy store.
Oh, for sure. I couldn't stop. I had to be reined in. I have such appliance envy in here. It's so much fun to be working with this high-end equipment. But yet we also chose equipment that was also what people would be actually using in a kitchen. Because in dietetics, they're trying to develop recipes for people that they will use in their own kitchens. So you don't want to have to tell them to use some sort of texture analyzer to end up with, you know, the correct texture for a particular product. They need to be able to use what we have here. So yeah, there was a good balance between buying too much and too high technology versus being practical.
Anne Vravick, congratulations on the new space, and thank you so much for showing us around.
Oh, thank you, and thanks for coming.
Anne Vravick is an adjunct professor in the food science program at Mount Mary University in Milwaukee. You can see pictures of the school's new food lab at WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break and then take a virtual walk down memory lane and talk about some of the many Milwaukee rep productions of A Christmas Carol over the years. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Earlier this week, the Milwaukee Rep opened the 42nd consecutive year of its production of A Christmas Carol. The adaptation of Charles Dickens' holiday classic has gone through a number of changes at the Rep over the years.
Writer Kevin Miller sat down with a number of the people who have been involved in various iterations of the play through its run, and the results are a piece in the current issue of Milwaukee Magazine. Miller came by the studio and talked about what he hoped to accomplish.
What's interesting about the piece that I did is that it's an oral history on the production. So the entire story is based around the quotes that I got from the four people I interviewed. And that just made it, you know, hearing it from their words, you know, because you don't want just like a writer inflecting, you know, what they thought about the play. So it was interesting just to get all of their takes, because the production started in 1976, so I wasn't even alive then. So to have the managing director, who was there for 20 years, tell me about how it started and all the evolution that the production took, it's very interesting.
42 years, which I was alive then, although I wasn't here. And there are, I think, three or four versions.
This is the fifth adaptation.
This is the fifth version.
Yes.
And so did that surprise you when you were talking to them, that that many?
Yes. Like you, I'm not from Milwaukee. I went to school here and have stayed here since. So I wasn't really sure of the history. I didn't grow up going to this production. I was even surprised when I heard that it had been, I know it had been going for a long time, but not 42 years. Yeah, and I sort of thought of it as this kind of static production that, you know, it's just the same story year after year. So it was very interesting to me to find out that there have been these different adaptations and the story has slightly changed. The story is more malleable than you think it is.
Right. I mean, that struck me too when you were, because you talked to Jim Pickering, who was Scrooge for 14 years.
Yes.
You talked to Deb Staples, who was in a production when she first started, as well as the managing director. And of course, Mark Clements, who just did the newest version, and it's going into its second year now of that. And I thought it was interesting how the social aspect of Dickens kept getting more and more put into each successive adaptation.
Yes.
More music, but also more social awareness.
Yes. Especially during the 80s and early 90s, Emmeline Gray's version seemed to be a reaction to Reagan politics, trickle-down economics, something that I had never really thought of. And when I was reading these old, like, 1980s reviews, I was like, oh, I kind of get it. I can see it. That's why this production has continued today, is the meaning behind the story can change with the times.
It can, but there's also, and I think it was Deb Staples pointed this out, it's like the core of the story about redemption and about, you know, learning from your mistakes and all of that sort of thing, that stays the same.
Mm-hmm.
That core piece seems to stay the same.
Yeah, it's a story that you want to bring your children to because it has good morals to it, but it's also, you know, for the old, you know, Grinch in the audience who is, you know, a penny pincher, and, you know, redemption doesn't have to happen, you know, when you're 8 or 9. Redemption can happen when you're 70 or 80.
Anytime.
Yes.
Actually, as long as you want it to happen,
mm-hmm.
pretty much. I know you did a lot of research looking at a lot of old playbills and looking at reviews and that sort of thing. Was there something that you discovered that made you kind of sit back and go, huh, I had no idea?
I think the story that Tonin O'Connor, the managing director, told about how she had the Hanratty Morgan production of the play put on in a jail in northern Wisconsin, and how the inmates learned a lot from putting on this production. I think that was surprising to me, that this play expanded outside of Milwaukee, and that, you know, even inmates in a jail could learn something profound from
it. So they actually acted in it.
Yes.
They produced it.
Yes, yes.
And did she didn't get to see that,
She
though,
didn't
right?
get no. to see that, I don't think so. But she heard that it went over well.
Yeah, I wonder if they still do it.
I don't know.
That would be fun to find out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How many versions of it have you seen?
For the Reps version, I've never seen. But that's probably because I didn't grow up here. You know, I didn't grow up going to it. My parents didn't take me to it because I'm not from around here. But I know that my children, I would like them to go see that. So I'm excited to bring them to it eventually.
And all of the productions, they're so much fun. And of course, the costumes and the ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a lot there, even if all you want is a fun evening in the theater.
Yes.
And don't want to think about redemption. You just want to have a fun evening in the theater.
Yes.
So are you going to go see it this year?
I believe I will.
I think you have to
now,
Kevin.
I think
Kevin.
I do. I learned so much about it. I just kind of have to see it.
All right. Well, next time we talk, you can report back what you thought.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much, Kevin.
Thanks for having me.
Kevin Miller's feature on the Milwaukee Reps long-running holiday offering of A Christmas Carol is in the December issue of Milwaukee Magazine. A Christmas Carol is, of course, not the only holiday-themed production on stage in Milwaukee at the moment. Across town in a much smaller venue, Scrooge in Rouge has a different take on the holiday classic.
The Madcap play at In Tandem Theater opened last night, and earlier this week, I sat down with In Tandem founders Chris and Jane Fleer and with set designer and muralist Linda Freund to learn more about how she created an English music hall both on stage and in the lobby.
Scrooge and Rouge takes place in the English Music Hall, late 1800s, early 1900s. So, you know, it's Christmas, it's English Music Hall. So in order to get the flavor of the times, the way advertising was done back then was through posters. So I took posters from the era for music halls and recreated them in chalk on the walls, directly on the walls. And then I created the gilded frames that go around them, because that's also from the period. And that's also done in chalk on the walls.
Do you have some sort of sealer over it? If so,
oh no, no.
Admire it.
Don't touch it.
Don't touch it.
Don't touch it.
Don't brush up against it.
Right. Yes. Yeah. It's all in chalk. So then, once the show closes, the walls get washed and it goes away.
That's sad.
like the ephemeral nature of live theater. You know, if you miss it, it's gone. Except Scrooge, which we bring back every 6 years.
Right. Yeah. Some things come back, but it's not the same.
It's not the same.
Yeah, no. It's never the same. Live theater from day to day. Same actors, different show, different audience, different... Something good or bad may have happened to one of the actors, and now, you know, they have to play through that and their relationship with the audience. So every performance is different. So that's, to me, that's what this exhibit is also. It's, you know, it's here now. It's live performance. And that once it's done, it goes away, never to be seen again.
Well, you are taking photos, though.
We did. We had our photographer in to take pictures of the show yesterday during the rehearsal, during our tech rehearsal, and I said, would you mind going out and taking some really good pictures of these for her portfolio and for us to put on our website, and so that we capture it and we remember it, because it really, her work is amazing.
Well, I'm sitting here, and I'm looking at this one, this little one over here.
Yes.
And from this distance, because of the way you've painted it, sort of the trembloy, it looks like it's a frame standing off the wall, and if I went up to it, I'd be able to pick it up and take it off the wall.
Right.
Yeah. You'll get chalk.
And I'll ruin it, and you'll never let me back in the theater again. But that, I mean, we're sitting here. We're surrounded by them. We're on the couch here in the lobby, and... they really do look like you could pick them up and shift them around. It's like, oh no, I want to hang that one over here.
Right.
How long did it take you?
This is 2.5 weeks, I think.
It was about 40 hours total. I was calculating the other day, and I, based on when you came in and the set and the other, I think it was about 40 hours worth of work.
All to get washed away.
Yes.
And then, of course, the time before that for the research. And there are a couple of them that are very connected to the show. We have a Seaside number, and there's a Brighton Seaside picture. Vesta Tilly was the infamous male impersonator of the time, and Vesta Virile, who's played by Elise Edelman in our show, is based on Vesta Tilly. So there's references. And then the now playing, she created on her own, which is specifically for Scrooge and Rouge, which you'll see the minute you start coming down that hallway before you even get to the lobby.
It's the big,
lobby,
like,
gallery.
Right today. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So why English Music Hall?
I have been a fan of British humor ever since I saw Monty Python on, you know, PBS when I was growing up in the early 70s. And do it, done Beyond the Fringe many times, and so this kind of humor has always kind of appealed to me. Benny Hill, you know, a little bit more on the body side. This is more like Benny Hill than Monty Python.
How does it fit here? Did you find when you did this in 2009 that people were attracted to it, even though they were not brought up in this tradition?
I was kind of surprised at how popular it was and how much people liked it. And then we did it for 2 more years, and I kept thinking, well, it's gonna wane, and it really didn't. People came back and saw it again, or they told other people about it, or they brought bigger groups to it. So after 3 years, you know, like we had been at, you know, three and out was a good way to go. And then we just had so many other things to produce, we didn't get back to it again. And now we're into a one and out. So this would be the year, and it'll come back sometime, but I don't know when. And I was very surprised and very pleased at how well it was responded to, because I thought people don't really know that British panto, or and people are a little
stock characters,
right? And they're a little gun shy of things they aren't familiar with. And so I was very pleased that people went out on a limb and came and saw it and went, oh, well, I get this, and it's funny, and it's easy. And
so for you, when you first designed this production in 2009, what kinds of things? Were you going to specific British panto shows in the past? What kind of historical things were you doing for research?
Well, I know that music hall stages are proscenium stages. That's the window that looks out onto the audience, where this stage is a thrust stage, like the rep stage is a thrust stage. It thrusts out into the audience. So how do you turn a thrust stage into a proscenium stage?
Without losing any seats.
Which is all important
here.
Says
the producer.
Yes. Exactly, exactly. So I, you know, did research on what music halls look like. That was my starting point. And how to find the elements that would put people in the seats of a music hall to see a show that takes place in a music hall. And so in the old theaters in Europe, there's these balcony seats that are almost on stage. They're so close and they overhang the stage. So I decided, okay, the side seating, those are my balcony seats. So it created walls and a void to separate the audience from the stage, give some pushback. So it is more stage-like. It's not an intimate space. I wanted it to feel bigger and crowded. And then the footlights added another dimension to that. And just having this void space from the footlights to where the audience sits creates more of a sense of sitting in a theater as opposed to a intimate black box theater.
So it was, for you, it seems like it was mostly trying to set the audience in the right place, and then the other pieces sort of fell into
yes,
place.
Yes, yes. That's mostly how I work when I've done set design. It's like, because I want the audience, if it's an intimate piece, I want to draw them in like they're a fly on the wall. But if it's a big bombastic piece, they need to sit back. To me, that's how you engage the audience into the show. That's the important part, how to get the audience that are sitting in their seats to connect to the actors on stage.
So where is the band?
The band is a piano, and the piano is just off stage.
Okay,
you
so
can
we don't
see him.
Oh,
you see him. And Alfred, who plays the piano, is an intricate part of the show in every way. He has lines, he plays the music, he underscores. He really just rarely stops playing. Very typical of the British Music Hall, you know, for segues and underscoring and effects. And because the premise of the play is that there was a troupe of 23 actors ready to do a musical adaptation of a Christmas Carol. 20 of them came down with food poisoning. There's three left to do the whole show. So
Including Alfred?
Well, he's four.
He's four.
He's
okay.
four. So the premise is nobody's doing what they normally do except the actress who plays Scrooge. But everybody else is wearing different hats, and even Alfred is called upon for sound effects that he normally wouldn't have to make, and the sound effect person doesn't always get the right sound effect when it's supposed to happen. And yeah, it's just a little chaotic.
Well, and I was going to say also, I'm sure there's a lot of ad-libbing of piano to cover some of these
issues. It was ad-libbed through rehearsal, and then we set stuff
it.
In stone. It's not an improv show, and we're not an improv company. That's so, I
meant it more. No, I meant it more in the world of the play.
Yeah, he's created some underscoring, or he'll take something from the score and put it somewhere else, so that we don't have those dead spots.
Linda, going back to thinking about set design,
yes.
And so what kind of tricks do you use when you have a limited budget, which I think most designers have a limited budget?
Yes.
How do you, how do you make people feel like they're in a music hall? You know, what are some of the tricks that you have up your sleeve?
Styrofoam. Styrofoam is God's gift to the theater, because it's cheap. and you can make just about anything from it.
You don't have to carve it, right?
Sculpt it, paint it, texturize it. Yeah, there's so much you can do with it. It's a mess,
So styrofoam is your friend?
Styrofoam and paint. You really do know how to manipulate color, and that helps a lot.
I love the idea of styrofoam and paint as being sort of the major tools in the tool belt for making us believe we are where we are.
And being able to, you know, do a faux finish or a trompe l'oeil on a set, you know, you can take plywood or styrofoam and make it look like something else. And, you know, you need marble, okay, throw some paint on it.
Suddenly inexpensive Luon becomes a beautiful marble floor or wall.
Yeah.
And then a good lighting designer is gonna accentuate that and help the audience lose themselves into whatever world you created.
Right, because that's the whole point, is to get them to suspend disbelief and walk in and be where you are. Well, I want to thank all three of you for talking with me.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Thank you, Bonnie. Great to see you.
Linda Freund designed the set and designed and created the lobby art for In Tandem Theater's production of Scrooge in Rouge, which is now open at the 10th Street Theater Space. Chris and Jane Fleer are the founders of In Tandem Theater. You'll find photos of Freund's artwork at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, it was a big week for composer and Milwaukee area native Justin Hurwitz. We'll learn why when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues now on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Aisha Turner. Today's Bubbler Talk is rooted deep in Wisconsin history and the story of escaped slave Joshua Glover. He fled Missouri for Wisconsin in 1852 and was imprisoned in Milwaukee under the Fugitive Slave Law. You can see the story driving on Fond du Lac towards Milwaukee's downtown. A large mural spans the walls of the I-43 underpass. It depicts abolitionists storming the jail and helping Glover to escape to freedom in Canada. One of WUWM's listeners, Rocky Martinez from Waukesha, was curious about the mural.
You know, actually, when I was going to a ball game, I took my boy to the ball game, I'm like, oh, that's Joshua Glover.
A few years ago, Rocky enrolled in a race and ethnicity class at Waukesha County Technical College. He was given an assignment.
And the instructor had us do a project and looking into local history. And that was one of the topics that we chose, was to look into the Underground Railroad here in Waukesha.
The only records he could find of abolitionists helping slaves were from Joshua Glover and Caroline Quarles, a woman who escaped to Wisconsin 10 years earlier than Glover. Rocky thought there was something strange. The picture of Caroline Quarles he found revealed that she was black but light-skinned, and there aren't any known photographs of Glover, only a black-and-white drawing that shows him as fair-skinned, with European features and a 19th-century suit jacket. Rocky wondered, were those abolitionists only helping light-skinned enslaved people? Maybe they were only helping slaves they identified more with. And if the Glover drawing is accurate, why is he depicted as dark-skinned with coarse hair and African features in the Fond du Lac mural?
But that's what I remember from the project. I'm not like a historian or anything like that, you know?
To get some clarity, I took Rocky to meet with Claiborne Benson from the Wisconsin Black Historical Society and Museum. Rocky showed him the drawing of Glover.
So this is the only image that we could find of him.
Yes.
And we don't know if that was accurate or not.
It's not.
The museum commissioned the Freeway Underpass mural in 2006.
That is a European version of Joshua Glover, but in actual description of Glover, he is a worker. Worked mills, cut down trees, he has dirty clothes. He is in no way polished that image projects.
So if that drawing of Glover is inaccurate, that means Rocky's hypothesis that only light-skinned slaves were helped isn't true. Claiborne explained that many of the white people to settle in Wisconsin were coming from European nations where they or their families had been serfs. They arrived in the United States deeply opposed to servitude. This abolitionist spirit became ingrained in the state's culture.
The state of Wisconsin goes on record as the only state in the entire Union to defy the Fugitive Slave Law. Now that's major.
It is major.
And Waukesha is a regional headquarters. for all of this activity.
So then we would have been able to find more cases other than Joshua Glover and Carolyn Corson.
There are many more.
Are there?
There are many more. If I were to guess, there's at least 400 to 500.
Oh, really?
Runaway slaves. And that didn't mean that cities and areas like Waukesha liked people of color. What it meant was that they did not want to tolerate with servants, slavery, and so they fought in any way they possibly can.
At the end of their talk, the men exchange email addresses.
Keep reading, that's all you can do.
Yes.
Keep reading, keep right. asking questions.
Claiborne promised to send along some books for Rocky to check out to learn more about Wisconsin's Underground Railroad.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union, a member-owned credit union dedicated to helping those who live and work in southeastern Wisconsin make informed financial decisions. More at ecu.com. Do you have a question about the Milwaukee area that you'd like us to explore? Well, if so, submit your question at wuwm.com, and maybe you'll be next to quench your thirst for knowledge.
Two of the seven Oscars the 2016 film La La Land won were for Best Original Score and Best Song. They were composer Justin Hurwitz's first Academy Awards. He also won Golden Globes and BAFTAs in the same categories.
Now he has a chance to add a Grammy Award to his mantle. He was nominated this week for 4 Grammys, including Best Compilation Soundtrack for Visual Media. We reached Hurwitz in California this past summer and wondered where he first decided to compose music for the movies.
I think I started thinking about film scoring towards the end of high school. I started composing when I was 10. But I wasn't thinking about films yet. I was just sort of composing. My parents had gotten me a synthesizer and a sequencer, which is a piece of technology that helps you sort of layer tracks on top of each other. So that's what I was doing my composing on when I was 10, 11, 12. And then, towards the end of high school, I started thinking about what could I do with music, with composition. And, you know, I've always loved movies. And I started really paying attention to film scores around that age. And I started thinking about doing it myself.
There's something about a film score that if it's done really well, you both notice it and you don't notice it. And it creates something. It adds something to the film that you wouldn't have without it, if that makes sense. And so for you, what is that thing? What is it that you feel that you're doing with a film that you wouldn't be doing, say, for just a straight concert?
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of, I think your description of what film scores do is great. I think that's exactly right. And I think there are different kinds of scores. Some scores are meant to pay attention to more than others. Some scores are really subtle, and you don't even really know that they're going on, but they are. And if you took them away, it would be a very different experience watching the movie. Whereas other scores, they're just, you know, they have big melodies that are just more in your face. So there are different kinds of scores, but I think generally scores kind of do the same thing, which is enhance the drama or enhance the emotion of certain scenes, foreshadow certain feelings or emotions. You know, sometimes there's a foreboding music that is giving you this feeling that is not on picture yet, you know, not on the screen yet. Something bad is going to happen, you know, maybe a minute later into the movie, but there are no signs yet kind of that something is going to happen. But the music can sort of get you feeling worried already, you know, before the bad things start to happen. So it can do that. It can also cut against, you know, the emotion in a scene. Sometimes if it's a sad scene and the music is sad, sometimes that'll just feel too on the nose. It'll feel, you know, heavy-handed. It'll feel cheesy. So sometimes you want the music to kind of cut against what's going on in the movie, in the picture, in the drama of the movie, and give us some sort of counterpoint to that. So it depends on the movie and the style of the movie and the style of the filmmaker you're working with. But yeah, music can do all sorts of cool things.
And with La La Land, I think the description you talked about of it can be big and melodic and obvious, and it can be also very, very subtle. I think you achieved all of those things in that score because you had the big numbers. It's a musical, but you also had some delicious underscoring that was so subtle in some places. Like, I had to go back and go, what was that? Because, you know, he's a jazz musician. And there's all of that happening. And so it seemed like in this one you managed to kind of get all of it.
Thank you. Yeah, there were, you know, a number of different kinds of cues, exactly like you described. There's, you know, some pieces of music like Planetarium or like the epilogue sequence where music is pretty much the only thing going on in the soundtrack of the movie. So you are very much paying attention to it. And then there are a lot of other cues that are under dialogue scenes or other kinds of scenes. And yeah, we didn't want the music to get in the way, but we wanted it to sort of enhance, you know, what was going on and add, in the case of this movie, in the case of a lot of what my cues were designed to do, to add a certain whimsy or a certain romance to a scene that, you know, it's maybe just Mia and Sebastian walking on the back lot of the studio, but the music is adding this kind of, you know, this sort of light, romantic quality to all of it, which I think is hopefully helping, you know, the experience of the movie and also helping us start caring about these characters and start, you know, feeling their connection and all of that. But you know, like I said, it's that hue that I'm talking about is, you know, under dialogue, so it's mixed low and it's trying not to get in the way too much. So yeah, lots of different kinds of techniques to sort of how the music is placed in the larger soundscape of the movie.
You and Damien have worked together quite a bit, and you worked on this film for what, how long, 6 years?
Yeah, about 6 years. We put it down for a couple of years in the middle to work on Whiplash.
Okay.
But we started working on La La Land in 2011. Yeah.
And so when you work together, and you've had a dozen or so years to do that, what is your process like when you talk with him about shots, about cues? I mean, do you come to the table together, or do you bring things to him? Does he ask things of you? How does that work?
Well, we've had an unusual process so far in that the three movies we've made together are, two of them are outright musicals, song and dance musicals, and then the one in the middle, Whiplash, is not a musical per se, but it was approached like a musical in the sense that there had to be music that was recorded before the movie could be shot. So on all three of these movies, I had to start working very early and start, you know, getting certain pieces of music ready before the movie was even shot. Normally, that's not the process for a film composer, so... So yeah, in these movies, we start really early and we talk about what the songs, or in the case of Whiplash, jazz needs to be for the scenes, what it needs to be dramatically. I'm reading the script as early as possible. And we're talking about, you know, primarily what the music has to do dramatically. And then also talking about certain references, you know, like, in the case of Whiplash, this tune should feel like this era of jazz and this should feel like that. So, there's that part of it, and then, you know, you get to a whole different side of it later after the movie shot, which is actually scoring it dramatically, scoring the picture, and that's just watching the movie and talking about where it's called spotting. You talk about where the music is going to be, you know. We watch it and we say, okay, we think maybe a cue can start here and end here, and you sort of lay out some very broad ideas of where music should go, and then we start talking about, you know, what it should feel like and what it should do dramatically. Because we do have such a long relationship, we do actually, even that part of the process is kind of a longer process than it often is, in the sense that we start talking about the dramatic underscore earlier, so a lot of times even before the movie shot, which is not typical. That's just because we've been working for so long and we know that I'm going to be scoring it eventually, so we might as well talk about it soon. That's sort of the phase we're in for the next movie he's making, which is not a musical. So there doesn't need to be any music actually recorded before the movie shot, but I'm already, you know, composing and orchestrating some, or arranging some, you know, ideas for score cues and what things can feel like. And, you know, we're already trying to get as much work out of the way so that when it actually comes to the time where I have to be scoring the picture, we figured a lot out. We figured out melodies. We figured out, you know, some arrangement ideas.
It kind of sounds like a grown-up version of that sequencer that you had when you were 10.
Yeah, it's just, you know, a lot of these pieces are made by experimenting and trying a lot of different things. And yeah, I guess that's what it was when I was that age too, is just, you know, trying a lot of things and realizing a lot of things don't work and throwing them out and continuing to do it until you have something that works.
One of the things you also do, which a lot of film composers don't do, is you do all of your own arranging. And mm-hmm. I find that fascinating because to me, that's a whole different hat that you have to wear to be an arranger.
Yeah. I arrange and orchestrate all of it. And I love that part of it. You know, particularly in something like La La Land, where the colors, the textures, the voice of the orchestra and how the orchestra is used was so important to how the score sounded and how the movie, you know, sounded, considering there was so much music in the movie and that it all needed to hang together. The songs, the score, the jazz, it all needed to sort of feel of a piece. Yeah, I had to do that part of it. And yeah, I was really proud of a lot of the, you know, the detail that I put into so many cues, so many just little, you know, dialogues between inner voices of the orchestra, dialogues between woodwinds and the voicings in the horns, the way that the horn 1, 2, 3, and 4 are all kind of talking to each other and handing melodies off to each other. And I really love orchestrating in that, you know, in a style that kind of, at least, you know, I won't do it in every movie. Certain scores will require completely different style of orchestration, but this type of score required a really sort of intricate, melodic, and counterpoint, you know, contrapuntal style of orchestration. So I really enjoyed that part of it.
Do you have to listen to your music as if it was someone else's in order to arrange it, or can you step right into it and know what you, as the composer, want?
I think I know what I want for the most part. I mean, there's still a lot of trial and error, and I try things, and then I have to get rid of things, and things don't work, or I find myself in a corner sometimes, or I show things to Damien and he says, you know, he's very specific in what he wants. So he, you know, I'll show him an orchestration and he'll say, it needs to be smaller, thin it out, or, you know, make it weightier here, whatever his note is. And he gets more specific than that. He's a musician. So he'll say, I don't like that oboe there. Add trumpets here. You know, so he has a lot of thoughts himself. I think to answer your question, I usually know what I want. When I compose it on the piano, I have a good sense of what it should be, but I still don't discover all the voicings and all the little counter melodies and all that until I'm actually putting it on the page. And like, that's a big part of the process for me, is actually seeing it on the page and looking at from top to bottom, from piccolos down to basses, and seeing the textures and how it all looks. And yeah, I just love kind of filling all of that in and making it, it's almost like painting in some ways. You're just like adding colors and textures, and it's one of my favorite parts of the process.
Well, Justin, it has been such a pleasure to have this conversation with you.
Thank you. Yeah.
Justin Hurwitz was nominated for 4 Grammy Awards this week for his soundtrack to the movie La La Land. We spoke with a Nicolet High School graduate this summer shortly before the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra performed a concert of music from that film. And that's all for the show for the first day of December. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Mitch and I produce the show along with Audrey Nowakowski, Joy Powers, and Mayon Silver. We get additional production help from Meredith Waters.
We also get additional reporting from Susan Bentz, Rachel Morello, and Ayesha Turner, web support from Michelle Maternowski, and studio engineering from Jason Reavy. Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Have a great weekend. I do hope we'll be a part of it. Join us for Lake Effect Weekend, Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3, right here on Listener Supported, 89.7 WUWM. Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air is next.